We're holding the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar, right? The fourth book in Chamisha Chumshei Torah, the five books of the Torah. Last week we ended Sefer Vayikra. If we'll quickly recap, Sefer Bereishis told us about the creation of the world, the lineage, the yichus of Am Yisrael, and that took us till we entered Mitzrayim. There's a very important Rashi in the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev. Rashi says that the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev is an introduction to the rest of the Torah. We had the story of the creation of the world, we had the flood, we had Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Yitzchak had two sons, Yaakov and Esav. And directly prior to Parshas Vayeshev, we have the story of what happened with Esav's offspring, down to the time they established their kings. And Parshas Vayeshev begins, Vayeshev Yaakov Be'eretz Mugurei Aviv Be'eretz Kenan. Yaakov settled in the land of Kenan. Eile toldos Yaakov. These are the offsprings or the happenings of Yaakov. Rashi says that pasuk is an introduction to everything else. The rest of the Torah, how Yaakov had children, that we saw in the previous parasha, but how there was a fight between Yaakov's children, and one child got sold to Mitzrayim, and ultimately the 12 tribes went down to Mitzrayim, and the Jewish people went down to Mitzrayim, and they were in slavery there, and then the 10 tribes, and then we got out of Mitzrayim, and our whole wanderings through the desert, till we got back to the land of Israel, which basically is the end of the Torah. That's all the happenings of the people of Israel. The people of Esav are described in a few short psukim, how their offsprings developed until they got a king. And our description of how we went down to Mitzrayim and went out, that's the rest of the Torah. So Eile Toldos Yaakov is an introduction to everything that follows. Well, what happened with Yaakov and his offsprings? So the rest of the Torah tells us. Sefer Shmos tells us about our exile in Mitzrayim and our redemption from Mitzrayim, including bringing us to Har Sinai and our building the Mishkan, Hashem's resting his Shekhinah among the Jewish people. And then we entered Sefer Vayikra. Sefer Vayikra taught us how we're supposed to act holy, how the Jewish people are supposed to act on a holy level. That includes the service in the Mishkan, the beginning of Sefer Vayikra, the korbanos, the different sacrifices, and a lot of mitzvos, like the whole Parshas Kedoshim begins. Be holy people. And now we're entering Sefer Bamidbar. Now, Sefer Bamidbar is going to recount our journeys throughout the desert. At present, we're going to embark from Har Sinai, theoretically on our way to the land of Israel. And then we're going to have the sin of the Miraglim, the spies, and the Jewish people saying they don't want to go. And then the journey extends for 40 years, which we'll also encounter in Sefer Bamidbar. And at the very end of Bamidbar, we again embark on our journey towards the land of Israel, and we fight our wars under Moshe Rabbeinu. We conquer the eastern side of the Jordan, and we conquer that whole section, which is a tremendous section. It's a tremendous amount of land, almost equivalent to the amount of land on the western side of the Jordan, what we call Israel. And Sefer Bamidbar really ends with Moshe Rabbeinu being 37 days away from his death. And Sefer Devarim encompasses those 37 days. Moshe Rabbeinu recounts during those 37 days what the Jewish people went through beforehand. But Sefer Bamidbar is going to take us from, the first pasuk takes us from Rosh Chodesh Iyar, 13 months after we left Mitzrayim, through the 40 years in the desert, up until Rosh Chodesh Shvat, and that Adar, a month later, Moshe Rabbeinu passes away, and that's the end of the Torah. So Sefer Bamidbar is really going to cover a tremendous amount of time in the Jewish people's history. It's not like the 200 years in Mitzrayim, but here we're going to get an in-depth look, together with the commandments, together with our journeys and travels during this time. The parasha begins, Moshe Rabbeinu is commanded to count the Jewish people. On Rosh Chodesh Iyar, 13 months after the Jewish people left Egypt, or 12 months and a half, Moshe is commanded to count the Jewish people. Now we know from Sefer Shmos, Parshas Kisisa, that Hashem told us that the Jewish people are not supposed to be counted. And if you count them, there's a danger that there'll be a plague among the Jewish people. So the only exception to that is if it's for a mitzvah, like over here, that Hashem commanded us to count the Jewish people. And even then, we say when you count the Jewish people, you shouldn't count people, but we count objects. So in the time of the Mishkan, each person donated a half a shekel, and they counted those. There are 9 times that the Jewish people were counted. The first time when we went down to Egypt. So the Pasuk says Hashem counted. There were 70 people that went down with Yaakov down to Mitzrayim. The second time is when we left Mitzrayim. So the Pasuk records that 600,000 people left Mitzrayim. Hashem counted how many Jews were coming out of Mitzrayim. There were 600,000 men other than women and children coming out of Mitzrayim. The third time the Jewish people were counted is over here. The fourth time the people were counted is later on in Sefer Bamidbar when it comes time to divide up the land. So the Jewish people are going to be counted and we're going to divide the land according to population. The fifth time is already in Sefer Shmuel when Shaul counted the Jewish people. And the sixth time again, Shaul had to count them before going to war. He was very wealthy. That's one of the places we see that a king is wealthy. He had each Jew take one of his sheep and pass it into a pasture, and then they counted up the sheep. He had enough sheep for all the Jewish people who were going to war. He probably was very wealthy, yeah. The seventh time was in the times of David, what we discussed in our class in Melachim. David made a mistake in counting the Jewish people. And the eighth time was in the time of Ezra, when Ezra, in the beginning of the Second Temple, took the Jewish people out of Babel, out of Babylon. So he counted how many people were here and how many people were there, how many Jews he had with him, how many Kohanim and Levim were with him. And the ninth time is in the future. Hashem says, when the time comes for the Messiah, I'm going to count the Jewish people. Now, counting is something we do with things that are of value. We have a rule in Halacha also, things that are called Dvarim Shebeminyan, things that are counted have more importance. And sometimes the Gemara discusses different opinions. If I have Dvarim Shebeminyan, are they ever batel? We have a rule. Let's say I have a piece of meat that falls in between two other pieces of meat. So I walk home and I find a piece of meat on the table and I say, this isn't a hechsher. This is a false hechsher. It's non-kosher meat. Sometimes you could say, okay, this isn't the hechsher that I want to trust, but that doesn't make it not kosher. Sometimes come home and you say, no, the chief rabbinate sent out a letter, this is a fake hechsher, there's no such hechsher, it's Arab meat, it's not kosher. So, okay, we got to get rid of this meat. I take it and I say, why should I lose the money I spent on it? I'll sell it to an Arab. Sell it to someone else. I'll sell it to a guy. What do I need to lose all the money? So I put it in the fridge, it shouldn't spoil. I come back to the fridge and I say, wait a second, there are two other identical pieces of meat there. Which one's the kosher one, which one's the non-kosher one? So we have a rule that things could be batel. Batel. Batel means nullified. So what does that mean? I know I have 3 pieces of meat and one of them is not kosher. But midoraisa, so biblically we say once one falls among two, so its halachic status might be nullified depending on the circumstance, depending on what happened. Let's say I'm cooking cholent at home and I'm carrying my baby in the other hand as I'm stirring the cholent. And he's drinking his bottle of milk, and suddenly he thinks it's very funny, he squirts some milk into the chilent. Okay, now I have meat in there, and I have milk.
One-sixtieth you're allowed, right?
So, biblically we say, batel berov, that the milk, again, biblically, this isn't an halacha class. Halacha is a different time, but we're just getting concepts here. Biblically, we say that batel berov. Halachically, the thing was nullified once it went into substances that outnumber it. If you have a drop of milk in a pot full of cholent and you can't see that drop anymore, it disappeared. So you say it disappeared. You could eat the cholent. Biblically, halachically, we have other criteria. There's also a criterion where we say, can you taste it? You have a friend who knows how to taste things well, have him taste it. Can you taste the milk in there or not? So there are all kinds of criteria. Again, we're not going into the halach. But when we discuss things being batel, that they lose their halachic status, So then things that are counted, we say they have extra importance. And it's not so easy to get rid of them. So when Hashem is counting the Jewish people, Hashem is giving importance to each Jew. And we're going to see more on that as we continue. So Hashem tells Moshe, I want you to count the Jewish people. And do it together with your brother Aaron. Do it together with the Nisim, with the leaders of each tribe, each Shevet. And this counting we're going to see is really setting us up for the next step. And that is we're going to divide the Jewish people to live according to their tribes. Up until this point in Sefer Bamidbar, everyone was living together. And we had the Mishkan, and the Jewish people were all living together. And what's going to happen now is that after the count, after we figure out how many people each Shevet has, the Jewish people are going to start living each Shevet in its own section. And we're going to have a very exact description as to where each Shevet is supposed to be situated. We'll get to that. So now Moshe is told to take with him the Nesim and Aaron, and together they're going to count the Jewish people. Who were the Nesim and how were they chosen? So the Pasuk tells us, Hashem told Moshe, take ish lamate. Take a person from each mate. We said mate is a staff, Shevet is a staff. Shevet and mate both represent the tribes of Israel. Each time we call a tribe, we call them either a Shevet or a mate. So what does it mean, ish lamate? Chazal said we have to read it a little differently. We have to learn ish lemato, down. The people who were most humble in the tribe, the people who weren't quick to make of themselves, those were the people who were the Nesim. And that's a rule we have. Chazal told us, people who chase after honor, the honor runs away from them. People who run away from honor, the honor runs after them. They say about the Netziv, who was the head of the yeshiva in Volozhin, that no one knew who he was. He was sitting in the back of Beis Medrash learning. He wasn't looking for the honor, but when a person learns and he's learning truthfully, then the honor comes after him. And that's a rule in general. We see it all the time. When a person tries to praise himself, so automatically people, their instinct is, nah, it's not so good. And when a person doesn't make something of himself, so people instinctively want to show appreciation to him. But the Nesiim were chosen because they were big Talmidei Chachamim, they were Tzadikim, and they were the people who knew the secrets of how to establish when it's going to be a leap year. The Jewish calendar is a lunar calendar. Now, we know that the lunar month is 29 and a half days. 29 and a half times 12, so you end up lacking a lot of days. You end up lacking, I don't remember how many days. We can do the math, but I don't remember right now. I don't remember. From the solar year. No, who could do math quickly? 29 and a half times 12. If you have calculators, it's easy. So yeah, isn't it 354? I think you're lacking 12. I think it's 354, maybe 354 and a half. Yeah, times 12.
The
254, right. 354, yeah. So you're missing 12 days. The solar year is 365. I'm sorry, you're missing 11 days. 365 days in a solar year and 354 in a lunar year. So you're missing 11 days. That means every 3 years, you're missing a whole month of the lunar calendar. So the Arabs, really, their calendar is totally lunar. That's why their holiday seasons always go back with regard to the solar year. They don't have any holidays that have to do with a specific season because their holidays keep moving back. Every year they lose 11 days versus the solar calendar. But by us, the Torah told us that we're supposed to celebrate Pesach in the summer and Pesach in the beginning of the spring and Sukkot at the end of the fall when we harvest. So the Torah told us we have to interject extra months in order to maintain our calendar, that there should be, that the months should be consistent with the solar calendar, with the time of year. So understanding how to do that is tricky. There are a lot of secrets and deep understandings as to how the lunar cycle works. NASA, the United States government has NASA, right? Everyone knows what NASA is. Okay. So NASA about 12 years ago came down to the second decimal point where the lunar cycle, figuring out exactly how the lunar cycle goes. something which we from our Gemara know already for over 1,000 years. So we have it in Masorah, and with all their computers and their satellites, they only reached that point about 12 years ago. So there's a tremendously deep understanding to how the stars work that the Jewish people have. The Torah says, "Ki chokhmaschem uvinaschem." That's your wisdom and understanding that all the nations are going to admire you for. And that's something which we have, the Rabbon Shalom taught it to Adam Arishon, and it was passed, and then it was passed generation after generation until it was forgotten, and Hashem retaught it to Moshe Rabbeinu. And that's one of the strengths of the Jewish people. We know that a girl who's a virgin, if she sits on a stick or something and she loses her virginity, Chazal told us till the age of 3, it'll come back. Now, what happens if she becomes 3, her birthday is in Adar, right? So she was born in Adar, or let's say it's in Nisan. Let's take a simpler example. And the year she's supposed to become 3 is a leap year. So that means for her, in order for her to become 3, she has an extra month over every other girl that becomes 3. So Chazal say, I think it's a Yerushalmi that says, that for sure, I guess they tested it, they checked it out, she gains another month. That if it happens then, she'll get it back. There's nothing in nature that we could point to. It's one of the powers we have that Hashem gave us. And that's why when we say in the davening and in the kiddush on Yom Tov, we say Mekadesh Yisrael veHazmanim. Hashem makes the Jewish people holy, and Hashem gives holiness through them to the zmanim, to the times. One of the greatest powers the Jewish people were given is their ability to make the times holy. We can decide when Rosh Chodesh is, we can decide when Rosh Hashanah is, we can decide if it's a leap year, and that affects everything. You had a month, so then Yom Kippur is a month later. All the biblically ordained holidays they're all contingent on the calendar, and we control the calendar. We're going to see Mitzvah next week, that one of the ways that when people tried to overrun us, one of the key ways to overrun a people is ruin their calendar. That's why the Russians always try to incorporate a 10-day work week. They're always trying to figure out a way of doing it. You kill the Shabbos, you institute a 10-day work week, you control the people. So one of the strengths of the Jewish people is their control of time, and their control of which time is going to be holy. And the top people, the Nesiim, our representatives of each tribe, they were the people who knew best. They knew all the intricacies of how to define when a month is going to have 30 days and 29 days, and when, I'm sorry, 30 days or 29 days, yes, or when we have to make the year a leap year, an extra month in the year. There are a lot of secrets and intricacies in that. They knew that. So they were the chosen people who represented each Shevet.
Yeah, but Hashem is the one who chose the leaders themselves.
Okay. Okay, but they were chosen for being with great traits, being humble, and knowing the learning as best as they could. When the Jewish people were counted, so the order in which the Nesim are represented, initially it goes according to the order of their age. Reuven, Shimon, Levi is skipped because Levi isn't part of this count. Yehuda, then Yisachar, and then it goes over to the sons of Rachel, and at the very end we stick in Naphtali, out of order. And Chazal tell us, like we discussed on Sunday, that because Naphtali had bad traits, Naphtali called his children, his first son was called Yachze'el. So Chazal say, why was he called Yachze'el? Because Machzin Dvarim Klapei Hashem. They'd cut their stuff, they'd speak in a way that wasn't right towards Hashem. Guni, that's because they would speak gnai one about another. That's the second son of Naphtali. So Hashem looked at them. These are people, the Jewish people are supposed to be unified. If they speak bad about one another, that's a bad trait. The next one was called Yetzer. They used to go towards their Yetzer. Chazal tell us, a person can either control his heart or let his heart control him. We say in Kriyashma, V'lo susuru achrei levavchem v'achrei neichem. Don't go after your heart. Our heart wants a lot of things. And the last one, the last son of Naphtali, was called Shileim. That's because Sholmu Ro'o Tachas Tova. The Pasuk says in Mishlei, Mishaleim Ro'o Tachas Tova, Iveles Hilo Uklima. If a person pays back bad for good, then someone does you a favor. And a second later, you turn your back on him. So first of all, that's a natural human tendency. No one wants to owe anyone anything. We have to work on ourselves to pay back what we get. But Chazal tell us that if a person pays back bad when he's giving good, Iveles he lo. For him it's a disgrace. People are going to look at him disgracefully ultimately. That's what happens here by Naphtali. The Shevet Naphtali is written out of order. They're written last because they had these bad traits. Sure.
So, then is it correct to say that there's a saying that you should follow your heart if you have a question and a huge lung or something like that, but according to what you said and what it says in the Shema, is there a greater understanding to this?
Well, a person is supposed to purify his heart. If a person is on a level where his heart is pushing him the right way, he could follow it. But it takes time for a person to get there. It's difficult to know what you're referring to. Like sometimes when people say that, they really mean follow your conscience. That deep down, and sometimes people say that they mean that deep down inside you know what's right. And that's also true. So that we fool ourselves. We could give a lot of reasons, but deep down inside we know what's right. So it's hard, depending on what you mean by that. Our heart is definitely going to pull us in the wrong direction as well. We could control ourselves and go in the right direction. And our heart is going to pull us in the right direction. Rashi says sometimes in Chumash, he says, I don't know exactly how the ephod was. The Kohen Gadol's apron. Rashi says, I'm not sure. I don't have a proof exactly how it was. V'libi omerli, but my heart tells me that this is the description. And he goes on to describe it. So they always say, if you have a heart like Rashi's, then you could quote what your heart's saying. But no, all of us... of course our heart also tells us good things. But, I don't know any rules in that. Levi didn't have a nasi. And the Pasuk tells us they were counted, they were gathered, and they were counted based upon their families. The Medrash says that's the connection between this week's parsha and last week's parsha. We ended Sefer Shmos, Hashem says, I gave the Torah, these are the mitzvahs that Hashem gave Moshe at Har Sinai. This week's parsha, we start off with counting of Am Yisrael, and Am Yisrael was counted, each one based upon their family, and each one based upon their yichus. So, the Midrash says that when the Jewish people were given the Torah, the nations came to Hashem and said, why are they better than us? And Hashem said, look at their wives. We spoke about women yesterday. Look at their wives. Their wives are faithful. Look at them. When they say a family, they know that their father is their father and their mother is their mother and the family is a family. And that's something that you can't say about yourself, Hashem told the other nations. So that's why the Sefer Vayikra ends, these are the Torah and the mitzvahs that were given to the Jewish people at Har Sinai. And this is the counting of the Jewish people based upon their families, that they had a family structure that was strong and consistent. And the next time the Jewish people are going to be counted is in the end of Sefer Bamidbar, after we have a situation where our enemies want us to fall. So Bilam, the prophet of the nations, tells Balak, you want them to fall? Here's what you do. Set up tents and have old women outside the tents and they'll sell wine. And when the Jewish men are going to come buy wine, they'll tell them, oh, but I have better stock inside and have other stuff inside. And when they go inside, you'll have beautiful girls waiting for them in there. And then you'll be able to get the Jewish people to sin. And that's what they did. And there were many Jewish people who fell for this. And right afterwards, there was a plague. A lot of Jews were killed. So Chazal tells that all the Jews that sinned, that went with women that weren't their own wives, they went with non-Jewish women, they were all cleaned out. And then Hashem said, now let's recount. Again, the Jewish people are clean. Again, I'm going to say, I'm a witness, the families here are pure. They maintain the family structure. Yeah, go ahead.
When you say the nations ask Hashem, why did they get to have to do that?
Oh, good question. So I always wondered that. How did the nations ask Hashem? And how did Hashem offer the Torah to the nations? We say that Hashem offered each nation the Torah, and each nation asked Hashem what was in it, and then they said, we can't abide by this, we can't abide by that. The Jewish people just said Nasev and Ishma. So I think from the Kuzari, I had a proof. I think it's from the Kuzari. I think it's from there. I don't remember where, but I saw someplace in one of the Rishonim that they explain it, that the nations, it might be a Rashi and Yechezkel, I don't remember. They explain it that the nations were given prophets and they were given messengers, and the messengers came to them and told them, this is what Hashem is offering you, do you want it? And when we say in the Medrash that the nation said like this, and Hashem said like that, so sometimes you could understand it that the Malach that represents the nation said that. which is what I always thought was pshat in the other midrash, that Hashem offered it to them means he offered it to the malach. But I never saw anyone that says that. And maybe that's pshat over here, that the malachim representing the nation said that. Or maybe we say that by the Jewish neshamos, we say, these are all, I don't have proofs for what I'm saying, but possibly, we say that when a person goes to sleep, his neshama goes up. So maybe the non-Jewish neshamas also go up, and then maybe they have claims. I don't know. Maybe.
But when they were asked, was this before or after Abraham? Because it was, if it was after, then we were already promised it. So it must mean it's before, doesn't it?
It's not before, because the doesn't seem like it's before. Let's put it that way. From the Midrashim in Vezos HaBracha, the description of the Psukim, it seems like it was directly prior to Matan Torah, to the giving of the Torah to the Jewish people.
We already promised it.
But were we told that it would be to the exclusion of everyone else? I don't remember. It's a good question. I have to look inside and see. I don't know. We have to check that. So the Jewish people are counted, and they're counted. Each one comes in and shows a letter, a piece of paper with their genealogy. This is my father, this is my grandfather, I come from this and this tribe. And this is something which I wanted to point out specifically here. A lot of us, we come from families where we don't know our genealogy that well. Before you start dating, it pays for you to take the time to speak to your parents, and if you still have grandparents, speak to your grandparents. Find out where you come from. For halachic reasons. You want to know if you're a kohen. If you're a kohen, you're going to be limited with what girls you could go out with. You don't want a situation like happened a while ago, that a guy went out with a girl and they were engaged to get married, and then when he went to visit the graveyards of his parents, so he saw they had this funny thing with their hands on all the tombstones in the family. And when he verified, he found out he was a kohen and he couldn't marry the girl he was engaged to. You don't want that. So you also want that if anyone asks you, how do you know you're Jewish, you have an answer. Well, I know who my father was, and I know who my mother was, and who his mother was, etc. It's good to know family history. You can't go back 10 generations, but if you could go back 2 generations, it's useful. And those of you that are becoming Gerim, then make sure to keep more than one copy of the files of the Gerus. And don't count on the Rabbanut. It was just a fire in Tel Aviv, and the Rabbanut's records were demolished. So do they have backups on that? I don't know. Someone mentioned to me that a substantial amount of their files were demolished. So you can't count on other people. You're responsible for your own yichus. The Jewish people here, when they came, had to show, I come from this tribe. Well, you don't want to be in that situation, but you always have to be able to say, I come from so-and-so. Someone asked something? Yeah. When the Kohanim go up there, so they split the fingers like this, and then they put the hands together usually. But we're not supposed to do it. I don't know. I don't know. I don't remember. Okay. So the 11 tribes are counted. We have the 11 tribes are counted from age 20 and up. Those are the people that go out to war, right? And they're counted, each person, and each person we know how much the numbers of each tribe is. I don't think anyone's specifically interested in hearing the numbers of each tribe. You want, look in the Psukim, it tells you the numbers each tribe had. The total figure was
exactly the same amount as when we counted last.
Correct. Was 603,550. Yeah.
Yeah, but the Rambam says it's a coincidence. I don't believe in coincidences.
So there are two other explanations why the numbers here are the same as the numbers in the count 6 months prior to this count. 6 months before this, the Jewish people were counted, and it was the same number. So how does that work out? So one explanation says that the way they counted age in that time was a person on Rosh Hashanah, everyone advanced a year. No one kept track of when their birthday was. On Rosh Hashanah, everyone became a year older. So if we're counting everyone from the age 20 and up, so no one became 20 between then and now because Rosh Hashanah hadn't passed. That's one explanation. Another explanation says that in the previous count, it doesn't say that the sons of Levi were excluded. So the previous count came to this number including Shevet Levi. And since then, a lot of people became 20. So now the whole Jewish people without Shevet Levi came down to this number. And the problem is that we have down to the single numbers. It says 603,550. So you don't have single numbers. So the question is, does the Torah round numbers? So that's a question in general. There are opinions in the Yerushalmi. Do we say that a large number incorporates a small number? So if you're speaking about large numbers, you don't always go down to the small details. Some say that we always round by one number. Like when Torah wants to speak about 39, it says 40. When it wants to speak about 49, it says 50. There are different explanations among the Rishonim how accurate, when the Torah says a number, what's the purpose. And the Gemara discusses it also. How exact are the numbers? Certain numbers we have to say are exact. It says, seventh day is Shabbos. You're not going to say, well, it meant the eighth. It says, 3 years after you plant the tree, you can't use it. And on the fourth year, it has din of revai. Well, you're not going to say it doesn't mean 3 and 4. It says, on the eighth day, you do bris milah. You're not going to say it doesn't mean the eighth day. So we have a lot of numbers. A lot of our mitzvahs revolve around numbers. What? No. Never heard of that. It says the eighth day, Vayom Hashem Nihi Mo B'Sar Lo So, it says in the Pasuk, Parshas Tezria. I don't know of anything like that, nope. So we counted the Jewish people. Now the Jewish, the Levim are supposed to be counted separately. And now the Levim are given their appointment. Until now, we had Kohanim with potential Kedusha, and it hadn't been brought to fruition. And we had the Levim, who had not sinned at the Chet HaEgel. And now the Levim are given a special command, and they're going to get a special Kedusha, special holiness. The Levim are counted separately, and they're given command of the Mishkan and all the utensils of the Mishkan. They're responsible for carrying the Mishkan when we travel through the desert. They carry it on their shoulder, a lot of the things. They carry with sticks, either the Aron that had its staffs to be carried by. And they're the ones responsible for taking down the Mishkan and rebuilding it. And the Levim here are given really the holiness of the Levim. When the Jewish people sinned at the Chet HaEgel, so until that point, every Rosh Chodesh was a Yom Tov for them. The Jewish people sinned, so it stopped becoming a Yom Tov for them. The women didn't sin, so the women still have a Yom Tov on Rosh Chodesh. That's why certain women have the custom not to do laundry on Rosh Chodesh and different tasks like weaving that the women don't do on Rosh Chodesh. Because they didn't sin in the eagle, so they celebrate Rosh Chodesh more than we do.
Is that why Rosh Chodesh is a woman's festival?
Yeah, because they did not sin at the eagle. So what about the Levim? The Levim, on the one hand, we're going to see now, they're going to get, in our parsha, they get the holiness from the Bechoros. But they don't have a Yom Tov on Rosh Chodesh.
Sorry, what's the Bechor?
Bechor is the firstborn.
Now
Hashem tells Moshe and Aaron to establish the people based upon each Shevet is going to have its own flag. And Chazal tell us, it doesn't say in the Torah, but Chazal tell us that the colors of each tribe's flag. Reuven, the firstborn, had a flag. Now, I'm sorry, let's go back a step. The flags all had a base color and a shape on it, a design. They had the name of the tribe. And according to some opinions, they had the letters from Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, meaning the first flag, right? Very good. At Aleph, Yud, Yud. So there were really 12 flags, one for each tribe, but there were four major flags because the 12 tribes were divided: 3 on the eastern front, 3 on the western front, 3 on the southern, and 3 on the northern. And we'll first describe the general flag of each tribe, and then we'll describe a little bit more. So the color, the base color of each flag was corresponding to the color of that tribe, the color they had on the choshen, on the breastplate. The base color of the flag corresponded to the color of their stone on the breastplate. So Reuven had a red-colored flag because that was the color of his stone, and he had the shape of the flowers, the dudaim, that plant that he had brought his mother to help her get pregnant again. Shimon had a green color, the base color of his flag, and he had a picture of the city of Shechem on his flag, because he was the one that destroyed the city of Shechem with his brother Levi. Levi had the color of crystal, bereket, and that was his color on the breastplate, and the flag, being the crystal, makes a lot of colors when light goes through it. So he had three colors on his flag. A third was white, a third was red, and a third was black. And he had on it a picture of the breastplate, because Levi, the coin comes from the tribe of Levi. Yehuda had the sky color, sky blue, and he had a picture of a lion, because that's the tribe of Yehuda is blessed with Gur Aryeh Yehuda. Yisachar, their color on the breastplate was sapphire, and that's why their color on their flag was similar, light form of black. And they had the picture of the sun and the moon, because they were the ones that understood how to do leap years very well and how to make Kiddush HaChodesh. They were on the Sanhedrin. Zevulun, he was Yahalom, diamond. And some say that the color was a pearl, the color of his flag. And he had the shape of a ship, because Zevulun was blessed that he would live on the port cities, and he'd do business outside by sea. Don had a color which, if I understood the French correctly, it was topaz, and he had the shape of a snake, because he was blessed to be like a snake. Naphtali had like red wine, which isn't so red, and he had the shape of an ayalah, which is a yubek or some kind of a dough, I don't know exactly. God had turquoise, dark black, and he had white on top of it, and he had the shape of an army, because God was blessed to have a very strong army. Asher had Tarshish, and he had the shape of a tree, because he was supposed to have good fruits. Yosef had Shoham, dark black, and he had two Nesiim, because he had Ephraim and Manasseh. His two sons were divided into two tribes. And Binyamin, his color, his breastplate was Yoshveh, and he had all the 12 tribes. Their 12 colors were incorporated on his flag, and he had the shape of a Ze'ev, of a wolf. Now, how were the tribes divided? We have on the eastern side, we had first surrounding the Mishkan, we had the Levim. And the Levim, Levi had three sons, Gershon, Kehas, and Merari, three children. And that's how the families of Levi are divided. On the eastern side, is anyone interested in this? Because everyone seems like they're out of it. If you're not interested, we'll skip it. Could continue. Should continue? Okay. So, should we draw it on the board? We'll do it. We have the Mishkan. What's a mil? Who knows?
Mil is a block.
Mil is 2,000 amos. Mil equals 2,000 amma. How much is an amma? Who could give me something I could understand? What's an amma?
18 inches. Forearm.
Okay.
18 inches.
Forearm. You say 18 inches. When you take a footstep, the amount you advance is about an amma. Meaning from the front of your toe, that's base, to the front of your toe that moved forward, that's an amma. So we have the Mishkan, we have the tabernacle in the center. Okay, on the eastern side. Notice, all maps you'll see in the Gemara, all maps you'll see in historical textbooks, east is on top. That's why east is called Kedma, because Kadima, you always look forward. So the people always look to where the sun rises. On all maps, you'll see on all ancient maps, not only Jewish maps, east is on top. But being that we're used to having east on the right, so we'll do that, we'll put north on top. So we have, on the eastern side is the entrance to the Mishkan. On the eastern side was the entrance to the Beis HaMikdash. Now on the eastern side, we're supposed to make the entrance to our shul, says the Rambam in the Rif. Rashi says they used to do that. It seems like in Rashi's time in France, they didn't do that anymore. But the Rambam in the Rif do bring it, that we're supposed to make the entrance to all our shuls on the eastern side, just like the entrance to the Mishkan was on the eastern side and the entrance to the Beis HaMikdash was. So, we have the eastern side. We have three children from Levi. Levi had Gershon, Kehas, and Merari. Kehas had... Who was Moshe Rabbeinu from? Moshe and Aaron. Their father was Amram, the son of Kehas, the son of Yitzhar, right? Hello? Okay. The son of Yitzhar, the son of Kehas. So, even though Moshe and Aaron come from Kehas, they're their own separate group. And they're on the eastern side. They're right here. Moshe, Aaron, and the kids. Okay, they're not such kids, but okay. Moshe, Aaron, and the children. Next. We have Shevet Yehuda. Yehuda is the tribe which was told Yehudam Chokoki. Yehuda is the one Lo Yosur Shevin. Yehuda, Yaakov Avinu already said he's the one that's going to carry the stick. He's the one that's going to be our king. The kings are going to come from Yehuda. So obviously the honor of the king is to be at the entrance to the greatest king. So Yehuda is over here and the tribes that accompany Yehuda. And that is Yod Yod, it's easy to remember. Yisachar and Yisachar and Zevulun. Zevulun and Yisachar are partners, right? Zevulun does the work and Yisachar does the learning. They had a partnership. On the southern side, we have Kehas, the tribe of Kehas, Moshe Rabbeinu's family, or close family. And we have Reuven, the Bechor, the eldest, even though he lost a lot of the rights that were supposed to come being the eldest, but we still give him certain credit for it. He's with Shimon and with God. On the western side, who do we have? Who knows? Okay.
Yeah, here.
We have Gershon. Okay, so let's figure out who's on the north. Well, who's left? Merari, right?
That's not hard. On the west, there's Ephraim.
So on the west, we have Ephraim, Menashe, and Binyamin. So we have all the sons. Ephraim and Menashe are the two sons of Yosef. And Binyamin is the other son of Rachel. So they're all close family. And on the north, we have what's left? Dan, Asher, and Naphtali. Okay, now these flags, this is the way when Moshe Rabbeinu was about, when Yaakov Avinu was about to pass away, he told his 12 sons, the 12 tribes, he told them, when you carry me to the land of Israel, you're going to carry my bed, this is how you're supposed to divide the carrying, in this shape. These three on this side, these three on this side, these three on this side, these three on this side. Now, when we read about this, it seems like, okay, they had flags, they were organized in a certain way, but the Kabbalistic explanations tell us that the people were divided down here the way in heaven the angels are divided. And the shape of the camp of Israel was corresponding to the shape of the camp up in heaven that surrounds Hashem. Now, what happened to the corners? Let's do measurements here. We have this whole thing is 12 mil by 12 mil. Yeah? 12 mil by 12 mil. How much is 12 mil? We said a mil is 2,000 amma. An amma is about 2 feet, a little less than 2 feet. So let's figure it out. No, calculator. About a kilometer? I don't know.
Times, we said 18 times 2,000, right?
Okay, 18 times 2,000, that's 1 mil. We have 20 by 20. 12 by 12, I'm sorry. How do we get to 12 by 12? Well, this area here, the area of the Mishkan, together with the Levim, which were a small amount of people, and was divided all around, that was 4 mil. 4 mil by 4 mil. 4 by 4. Okay? Now each tribe over here got 4 by 4 also. 4 by 4. Same thing here. Okay? All around. What happened to the corners? The corners is where they left their animals to graze. That's where they had their animals and all the stuff they kept there. So we have the Jewish people. This is how they traveled. The Levim were divided into 24 Mishmoros when it came time for the Beis HaMikdash, 24 divisions in the families, who's in charge of watching what. And the Levim were given in our Parsha the responsibility for watching the Mishkan and also in the Beis HaMikdash, that the Jewish people don't come in, and also watching out of honor. There were 21 places in the Beis HaMikdash where the Levim had posts at night. And there was one head Levi who would walk around and check. And he'd tell him hello, and if the guy answered him, good. And if not, he'd get a whack. And if that's if the guy who was in charge was kind. If he was a little less kind, he'd take the torch he was holding and put it on his clothing. So Chazal tells us that they had very strict rules in the Beis HaMikdash. You're standing here, you're serving Hashem. We're not worried that the enemy's going to attack. The guards in the Beis HaMikdash is out of honor. If you fell asleep on guard duty, you deserve to be killed. So they didn't kill anyone, but they certainly weren't kind to them. They'd punish them. The Levim had to watch that the Jews don't come close to the Beis HaMikdash. We have a tendency to want to come close to what's holy. And at the end of the parasha, the Levim were taken from age 30 and up instead of the Kohanim. Here the Levim are going to get their holiness. And, instead of the Bechoros. Initially the firstborn were supposed to be the ones who served Hashem like the Levim. But the firstborn sinned in the Egel. Moshe Rabbeinu comes down from Sinai and says, who's for Hashem? Come to me. and the firstborns don't come, so they're no longer for Hashem. The Levim do come. So now the firstborns can no longer be in this service. So the Levim are supposed to get the holiness instead of them. Now, the problem was that there were more firstborns than there were Levim. So Hashem said, we'll redeem the firstborns with 5 silver coins, like we do when we have a firstborn son. He can't serve anymore. So we redeem him with 5 silver coins. That the Torah says. We have special mitzvah in the Torah to redeem our firstborn. So the Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know how to decide which firstborns everyone's going to claim. I had a Levi that's equal to me. Why should I pay the 5 silver coins? So they drew lots. They put lots in a big utensil, and the amount of Levium they had, so those lots, they put those number that said Levi. And then they put the extra amount of Bechoros, firstborns that they had, they put a piece of paper that said, gotta pay 5 slot. And everyone drew one, and then they saw, was I redeemed by Levi or not? So you'll ask me, how do lots work? So we know that lots throughout the Tanakh, lots were used to prove what Hashem wanted. I had in my family a cousin of my grandmother's passed away, and there was a Sefer Torah left in the family. And it wasn't left, they didn't know who was supposed to get the Sefer Torah. So all the kids said to the younger brother, they said, you know what, we'll draw lots. And they drew lots, and the little kid came out that he won the Sefer Torah. So all the siblings said, he's a little kid. No, can't be. And he was a little kid, so he didn't put up a fight. So they said, okay. They put all the lots back in again, and they drew again. And again he came out the winner. So we have many times in the Tanakh also that drawing lots was used to show what Hashem wants. Now, the Levim, this holiness that they were given was a responsibility to carry the things of the Beis HaMikdash, of the Mishkan, I'm sorry. But it was also, to an extent, to their detriment financially. They no longer are going to get a large section in the land of Israel. They get small cities to live in. They're not giving them a lot of land. And that's because they're supposed to be serving the Jewish people on their spiritual level, teaching and learning. And that causes a problem. They're contingent on the people. They need people to support them. So Hashem gave them a support system. Hashem said you have to take a tenth of any crop, the crops you bring in, you have to take a tenth, ma'aser, and you give it to the Levi. The Levim get it starting from this week's parasha. This week's parasha, they get their holiness and they get it. And the pasuk says in Mishle, al tigzol dal ki dal hu. Don't rob a poor person because he's poor. So you ask yourself, what's the pasuk telling me? So Chazal tells, that's talking about the Levim. We have a tendency when we look at someone poor, we respect him less. And that's not so. We're supposed to give him equal respect. He's a human being. He's created in Hashem's, the same shape of Hashem as I am or anyone else's. The amount of money a person has in the bank isn't a reason to give him respect. We owe respect to a person who has money. There's a special chiyuv to give extra respect to a person that has money. That is true. But there's no permission to give any less than common respect to a person that has less money. And we'll end with a story, but we'll first introduce the story. When we quote stories, we have to know that if we're quoting something from Tanakh, so that's what the Torah says, we have to learn from it. If we quote something from the Gemara, so we have to understand it, what it's teaching us. And when we quote a story that people tell over, so we have to know that's a story that people tell over, but you can't learn halachos from it, and it doesn't carry the weight that anything else carries. It might be true, it might not be true, we don't know. So this is a story that's been going on in the Jewish people for many years. It's even quoted in Sfarim, but to tell you I would swear that it's true, who knows? The story goes that there was a person who was a big Talmud Chacham, he was a big chassid, he had tremendous midos, and he wanted desperately to know when he gets to the world to come, who's going to sit next to him in Gan Eden. So he fasted for a long time, and he prayed, and he begged, until one night he had a dream, and they told him, your friend, the one who's going to sit next to you, is going to be on your level in Gan Eden, in the world to come, is the butcher. So he hears this, he thinks, boy, what did I do wrong? So he was sad, he tried thinking, and he looks at the butcher and he says, me and him, we're equal. So again, he started fasting, again he started praying, he thought maybe there was a mistake. So again, he's waiting for a response, and he gets a response, yeah, the butcher is going to be your neighbor. And when he heard this again, he started crying, he was destroyed. And he couldn't calm down until finally he heard a voice telling him, you should know, you deserve to be killed for what you're doing. What are you getting so upset about? That butcher, you know how much, what amazing things he did? And no one has come close to that butcher, and you're being told you're going to be next to him and you're crying? So when he heard this, he got up early in the morning and he went down to the butcher store and he said, and he told him, I want you to tell me, what do you do? So the butcher told him, he said, I'm very careful to be an honest businessman. I don't go off on the weights even a drop. I make sure my weights are exact. And when a poor person comes to me, I try to give him a good portion like I would give a wealthy person. I don't treat him any less well. And when I make my money, so I give a lot of it to tzedakah, and the rest I support my family with. So Talmud Chacham said, he said, that can't be all, because you must be doing something special. There are other people who are honest businessmen and they give tzedakah. Think, you must have done something exceptional in your life. So the butcher is thinking, he's thinking. Then he said, you know what? Yeah, there was something once. One time I was in my store and there was a caravan of non-Jews passing, and there were a lot of people that they had captured, that had gone, I don't know if it was a crusade, or that pillaged a village, and that captured a lot of people. And they were traveling, and they passed by my store, and I heard a girl there crying bitterly. And I went over and asked her, what are you more bitter than everyone else, and what's wrong? And she told me, look, I'm a Jew. I'm not like everyone else here. And I'm wishing that someone, they'll bring me near a Jewish town, that a Jew will redeem me. And I told her, don't worry, I'll redeem you. I didn't have the money for it, but I put it together from wherever I could get it. And I bought her out, and she was 12 years old at the time, and I let her grow up in my house as though she was one of my own kids. And when she grew up, I had a son who was 21 years old, and I told him, look, she doesn't have a father. Who's going to give her a dowry? Do me a favor. I want you to marry her. And we prepared a wedding, and I invited all the people of the town, and I prepared the best foods, and I promised my son that I'd support them as though she were my daughter, as though I were giving her the dowry, even though he's my son. And I promised everything. And I invited everyone from the town, and I gave everyone equal places, and I honored everyone, and I made sure everything was great. And then as we were getting ready for the chuppah, I walked by table, and I saw people upset. So I asked the people, what are you upset about? Are you missing something? You weren't served? What did I treat you unfairly? And they told me, no, but it's hard to be happy. We have a guy here sitting at the table wailing away. And I look down the table and I see it's true. There's a guy there wailing. So I ask the guy to come with me. I take him outside and I ask him, look, well, what's wrong? Do you need a loan? What's wrong? And the guy tells me, you know, this girl that's about to get married, I was engaged to her. And I have over here a piece of paper that shows that she was legally engaged to me. And she's not even allowed halachically to get married to anyone. And he gave me, the butcher tells the story, he says he gave me proof that it was her. He gave me identifying marks. And then I went and I called my son. And I told him, you know, I have to ask you another favor. Halachically, you're not allowed to marry this girl. No one's going to know it, but you can't. I mean, she was promised to someone else. And my son agreed, and we married them off, and I danced over there as though it were my own son. And I gave them everything I promised to give my son, I gave her, as though she were my own daughter. And I gave them Sheva Brachas like I would have supported my own daughter. Everything I did. And when the guy heard this, I said, okay, so now I understand why we're together in Gan Eden. Now, we have to remember this because, A, when we look at people, we can't judge who a person is based on what he looks like outside. That's why Hasidim always tell all these stories about hidden tzaddikim. You don't know what a person is, who's up and who's down. And going back to the pasuk we quoted, that in treating the levim, the Torah says we have to be extra careful. I think one of the things we have to take from that today is when it comes to people who teach. Unfortunately, there's a tendency that I can't pay full tuition, I can't do this, I can't do that. People are very easy to skimp when it comes to fulfilling what they owe to when they send their kids to school. I mean, you look, I don't know how it is here. In the United States, they charge tuition based upon the assumption that two-thirds of the people aren't going to pay full tuition. And that's not right. I mean, whoever can't. But we have an obligation to try and think what we own, what we don't. And We have an obligation to do that. The Levim were in a situation where they were contingent on other people, and the same thing is true today of other people in our society, and we can't look at that and take advantage of that. The other way around, we have to recognize what our obligations are and fulfill them. So, call to.